Welcome back to The Brandon White Show, where we have conversations worth listening to give you an edge to win in your business and your life. I'm your host, Brandon White. Here we go.
Welcome back to The Edge Podcast, giving you the edge to win in business and in life. Here's your host, Brandon White.
Apple's rolling. What's happening?
It's a beautiful day at Half Moon Bay. I am so glad that we had a good excuse to come out here. I love the ocean. So it's a wonderful day. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. For listeners, Alp and a longtime friend of mine, Chris McGay, are working on a company that I found really interesting. So this is going to really be for tech geeks out there that want to talk about Spectrum. But I want to talk about your background and sort of how you got here to this spot in this opportunity when we're talking about we're talking about wavelengths today is really what we're talking about, aren't we?
That's right. That's correct. Yep.
And Chris and I went to high school together and we've stayed in touch over the years. And he said he was doing this company and I was like, I want to hear about it. And I think it's a good story for people out there who are may have some sort of technology and are looking to commercialize that and actually make some money off of it. So I think it's a good story. Let's talk about what you are doing right now, and then let's go back and sort of dive into your history on how you wound up here, because you're actually a technical person, aren't you?
That's correct. Yeah. I did diverse things in my past lives in the last 30 years in the industry. But I'll say technology is first. I've done business, being business unit leaders, looking at P&Ls and boring Excel sheets. But at the end, my heart is still being a geek. So in truth, that's where the core comes from, my interests.
So you guys are doing AT. I need to actually look at this when I'm saying it, because there's so many acronyms in the world and so many different industries out that I think it gets a little bit crazy. But you guys are doing something with the ATSC 3.0 spectrum. Can you explain to listeners and those out there who might not know what that means, what it is?
Right. So ATSC 1.0 has been around for decades prior to 3.0 was ratified in 2017. So it's basically live video transmission, live TV broadcast. So back from all the way to 50s, federal government licensed certain amount of spectrum between the UHF, VHF band, roughly 50 plus channels. And so if you talk to your grandparents, even your parents maybe, and even a lot of people today still, the only way to be able to receive TV signals, look at ABC, NBC, listen to news, you will get these rabbit ears and plug into your TV. And when you actually watch that live broadcast, it went through an ATSC signal. And the original ATSC 1.0 that was used, we roughly get basically in any region anywhere from 10 to 20 channels that you may get, sometimes 4 channels. It all depends on the size of the metro population. But at the end of the day, as in simplest term, is live TV broadcasting to be brought to your home, to your TV.
Does it make me old that I actually used to watch TV with rabbit ears? That I remember there had to be a cable run from our TV room in the den to the chimney so that you could do direction with the antenna, right?
That's correct, right? You are, depending on where you are, you'll get the best by making sure that's aligned in the direction of where the transmission was coming from. Exactly. That's right.
So that still happens today, though. I mean, I think people don't realize it because we're so used to cable and things like that. But if you, and I know this because my wife got an antenna for the RV that actually does turn. And when she goes and she doesn't have hookup somewhere to a cable, and we don't have or don't have enough internet to actually stream, then she'll get like 50 channels still. And you can do HD over that, can't you?
Correct. So the ATSC 3.0 is an HD. It's not 100% of the markets yet, but you're seeing the adoption, even though the ratification was 2017, but you were still probably in the 60 percentile range in the United States in this 3.0. Every month, every quarter, more and more markets, the 3.0 is being lit up right now. 3.0 is HD content. The 1.0, which is still majority of the, what are the old TVs that you will see that's being in most of the majority of households today, they have, it's an SD content, right? But at the end, then it's still a TV broadcast.
So wouldn't the TV broadcasters rather broadcast over this than actually have to push through the pipe?
That's correct. Part of it has to do with FCC. When they did the 1.0 transition, there was a deadline, a sunset rule on going from the old format to the new format that they have, which then forced everyone to update. The way they did that today, in short summary, I'm not a lawyer, legal, all the terms to give it to you, there's no sunset rule. So they now, which means that you still need to broadcast 1.0 and 3.0 simultaneously, which is, makes it more difficult for when do you go 100% and when do you, because there's a capital investment every broadcaster would have to do, install and upgrade the towers to 3.0. While it's not that much, a huge amount of investment, you can still use the same infrastructure, but it's a matter of time. But it's right now we're seeing the light, because if you look at all the new TVs coming out from Sony, Samsung, LG, et cetera, you'll have to look at the little blurb there. They will say over the air. Some of them may not have the whole description on ATSC 3.0. They might say HD over the air. But in short, that you'll get the chip. The receivers are already built into these TVs. So all you'll have to do is buy an antenna and plug it in, and you'll be able to receive that. For the old TVs, the only way to do that, you would have to buy a third-party receiver. You can go to Amazon. There's others. There's more and more solutions being popped up today, set-top boxes that you could actually plug it in and then turn your old TV into a 4K receiver. As long as it can actually 4K display 4K, you'll be able to see an amazing quality.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking from a expense standpoint, and maybe we're going to go from the antenna to the pipe, as I call it, the internet, whether that's fiber or cable, and then back, because for providers, there's a cost to send that over the internet.
Correct.
Where the cost for them to broadcast is much lower. Is that true?
A true statement, in the sense that because when you do broadcasting is one to many, whether I'm going to use TV as a consumer example, but it could be any application, which we'll talk more about later on. But when you do broadcasting, it's one to many. Whether that is one TV receiving a signal or 100 million TVs are receiving, really there's no difference because it's being broadcasted. As long as every receiver has an antenna and a receiver, they will be able to get that. When you go to a cable provider, or you go to a streaming solution from Netflix, Disney, et cetera, it's all IP based, which is one to one, right? So if one person is using it, it's a one pipe, but if there's 100 million people using it, it's a 100 million pipe. So there are multicast solutions. There are ways to do that. But at the end of the day, there's caching solutions, CDN, on the telco edge. If you look at that, they are trying to offload what they have. But there is still a cost at the edge. And regardless, whatever you do, closer you get to the edge, that pipe then multiplies to the number and becomes one-to-one.
Yeah, so I guess it's more about adoption and consumers right now, because consumers don't want to put an antenna up. And I'm just talking this through and thinking it through, where this is evolving, because there could be an opportunity to actually push your broadcast over this spectrum versus pushing it over the internet. But I think and you and I and Chris were having lunch today talking about this. The challenge there is to make sure that the device that you're using has that receiver in it for that spectrum.
Correct.
But I wondered, like, does this Apple computer have it, do you think?
No, there isn't, unless you get a USB stick and plug it in.
You're absolutely right. So that's really the issue, is that the manufacturers have skipped or abandoned that almost and said, hey, we're not going to do that over the air because everything's going over the internet. But the internet still, even today, in today's day and age, still has trouble, because back when we had cable, and you were talking about this, and I'm saying this more for you as a listener, if you're interested in this and you're listening and you're not a tech geek like Alp and I, but that's why when kids come home from school and they're all gaming and you're on cable, your cable slows down. On fiber, it's a little different because it's optics and it doesn't slow down as much. Although, does it actually slow down? Do you know? on fiber?
It will slow down because the network traffic, you still have a switch, which is limited to a certain amount of bandwidth. So if every house is doing it, it will.
But it's not quite as bad as is pushing it through the copper cable.
Absolutely correct. Now, yeah. You have a bigger pipe, if you want to think of it that way, pipe numbers of bandwidth, but you are still going to clog it at the curb, because if you're a cable customer or whatever, it's still going to have a, it's just a funneling effect, right? You may be okay in that house, but if every house is doing something similar, which is going to be around dinner, right before, right after dinner, everybody's starting to stream, you will see your latency going down. So if you have a kid who's playing a gaming, they're going to start complaining because everything will start lagging a little bit more. You may have tearing in your whatever movies that you're watching. You will see it versus later on in the evening or earlier in the morning. You're not going to see those. And that has to do with more, not your network connectivity, whether you have fiber or copper into your home, but there's too much data being pulled in and out of your home all at the same time down to the curb where the main switch is at, which is going to the backhaul.
Yeah, so that becomes a problem. I'm just, as a business person, thinking there's opportunity in the spectrum that everyone's moved to the internet. They're still broadcasting, but you don't have these issues because it's one to many. You don't experience that. The real limiting factor is at the tower and the power and your distance.
Correct. Exactly.
So if you could put a tower in the power and you could get to these TVs or devices, then you could do that. I'm sort of going down a rabbit hole here that I don't know that it makes sense. But I was just curious to pull that string, because the question that I'm thinking is, did we go to the internet? We're pushing, all these media companies are moving things to the internet, meaning they're moving it over IP. And they moved it out of the spectrum into IP. They're still broadcasting because they may have to by law, or and may want to for some cases, but it's really your cable connection into your house is now your media connectivity, and your computer, your phone, your screen, whatever that screen is, has now become your viewing platform.
Correct.
And now effectively it's an a la carte channel, where you can get the Disney Channel, Disney Plus, you can get Netflix, you can get, what else do I just
say? Hulu.
Hulu. What else do we just say? So, yeah. Apple TV.
Apple TV.
So now it's just that it's not bundled anymore. Although we have AT&T here, we have fiber, but everything is coming over that fiber. Internet, TV, quote unquote. I don't even know, is TV, what does that even mean anywhere? It means television broad, what is it, TV? What's it stand for? Do you know?
Yeah. The television, which is, what does it stand for?
TV.
Yeah.
So, but it's not even TV anymore.
Correct.
So, this is a whole paradigm shift that blows my mind. I think it's similar to the phone. We think about that thing that you and I have here on this desk as a phone. But isn't that an old word? Isn't that just a computer that has voice on it?
Yep. And then now it's become your identity management. It's actually, you use your phone to prove who you are. So it has become more than a phone, to your point. Now this is only way, whether you go to an app, it says, well, check to your phone, to FA authentication as an example. Your phone has become a security feature. It has nothing to do being a phone anymore, right? It has become changed to what it's being used for.
So TV just isn't even a thing. So now the question becomes, how fast are the speeds? It's not, are faster speeds possible? It's, can we get those faster speeds to the edge?
Correct.
And usually that means infrastructure. It hasn't yet been proven through the air to get, or wavelengths, we're at 5G. So are we getting gig? We're getting gig, 2 gigs at a second.
Yeah, 1 gig speeds. The problem you have is more the backhaul being caught up. So the biggest issue is you can promise speeds up to, right? But the problem is in reality, in a sustain. I mean, if any gamer out there would know that you look at your bit rates in terms of download, upload, you can test it. And that would also change the latency. There's a few things you always care about, the speed of upload and speed of download and your latency, closest cross-connect. So those three things are going to determine your experience on anything that you do. So the yes, you may be able to go faster, but if everyone is going at the same time, the pipe that's going in the back hole and the back end is limited. It cannot support everyone doing everything at the same time. And because now everyone is relying more and more traditional way of doing things, not just watching TV, but everything else. Even your oven now has smart ovens, smart TVs. They're downloading things in the background that you have no idea. It's during Thanksgiving. There's a Thanksgiving picture that popped up in your oven. How did it even get there? Right. And then at home, one of the other things I want to, it's very interesting that while the speeds are increasing, but you're also capped on how much your bandwidth you can use for the month. So we have done some interesting studies. So you go to a cable provider and your limit might be 1.2 terabyte, I mean petabyte, right? And it sounds like should be plenty, right? But in reality, if you stream Netflix, even if you through your cable provider, it counts against your data cap.
So that is true. I will say this from an AT&T perspective, because I actually asked that when. So I'm just doing the use case and we can talk through it. We, meaning Yvette and I, here at the house, we said, hey, look, I'm done with cable. Cable was 300 megs and I wanted gig. They did run fiber to the neighborhood. We got fiber. My strategy was to keep cable on the copper, meaning with Comcast.
Sure.
And to use my internet with AT&T. Now, Comcast was making us buy a bundle because they realized that fiber is going to kill the copper. But that was the strategy. Then AT&T said, hey, look, we can give you that same bundle of channels, not calling it TV anymore. It's really just channels.
Channels, yep.
And my question to them, and Yvette said instantly, yes. And I said, well, yes and maybe, because are we, to your point, if I'm going to run the TV and watch sports and we're using it for the internet and we're using it for stream, like we're basically using this fiber pipe for everything.
Yep.
Are you going to cap my bandwidth? Because I'm going to go, over it's just it. A fact. We're going to go over it. I do a ton of uploading and downloading. Yvette does. And then on top of the TV and all these other devices that I want to go into and talk about, but the car is updating, the refrigerator is like, everything in this place is updating.
Yep.
They, with the bundle that we got, said no cap. Now, they're obviously running the numbers and saying, hey, look, people aren't, they're betting on the averages. I imagine. But there is a truth that in most regions of the United States, there probably is a cap.
Yeah. Like what region where I'm at in Phoenix, Scottsdale, my cap is 1.2. And if I watch Netflix, it goes against
terabytes.
Yep.
1.2 terabytes. Well, then you must go over all the time.
All the time. So, that is a challenge. And there's an additional challenge. When you look at the number, you will think, okay, 200, yeah, maybe you might be okay. There are a month that I'm under. Now there's a $49 thing that you can't even find right now. It will give you unlimited, but you have to pay another $49 extra, but which you can't find anymore. It was only available a year and a half ago during COVID. And one of the other challenges, if you have kids at home, one of the things that's amazing, let's say you have a PS5 or Xbox. Let's say on average kid, if they have 4 to 5 games, each game updates as much as 2 to 3 times a month. Updates are anywhere from 20 to 100 gigabyte. So think of adding just 3-4 game updates, one or two times a month. You might be a big chunk of your data cap that you're going to give up before even you did anything else, right? So I know I'm going on a rabbit hole as well, is that, you know, too, because I was going back the ATSC. I want to tell you a quick story in terms of last year during Super Bowl. We had a party at our house. We had a really low-end 4K TV outdoor, and we had a 4K TV in our family room. So we had a bunch of friends over, and the outdoor TV had an ATSC 3.0 receiver that I had gotten hooked up to it. And inside had the cable TV providers, 4K, live being, the TV being 4K, just HD content. And everybody after watching during the football game, they were shocked. They're going, oh my God, your TV outside is unbelievable. Even though TV inside was 4 or 5 times more expensive than what was inside and a better quality and all that. But because the content was 4K and Dolby Surround and everything that was being delivered over the air for free, versus inside what I was getting as an HD content, it was an unbelievable image. The difference were amazing.
So the outside that was hooked up to the signal was clear.
Amazing. Pure 4K, right? I mean, you could see all details, not to mention from the latency perspective, it was almost, I would say, not quite a second, but 0.8 seconds. So it was kind of funny if there was a bunch of people outside in by the pool watching the outside TV when something cool happened and they would yell, everybody in the family room go, what? And then by the time they turn, they would miss the play because it was actually, as you go through all these cross connects, your actual TV, cable TV was about, let's call it about a second behind on the play what's happening in real time. The latency is also lower so that you actually were seeing it closer to real time, not real time ever, but closer to real time. So it was always ahead actually on what was happening on the TV side.
Yeah, I have to say, we have that same experience in the RV. I mean, the RV, our RV doesn't have the, I don't know what we have, an LG or I have a TV that has Dolby Atmos and Dolby Vision capable, which was important because when you see that stuff in Dolby, it does change. But to your point, if you can't get the bandwidth, which Apple TV is in the white household, the whites here, our household, it's terrible. Like Apple TV is horrible. And it's not because we don't have the bandwidth, because we have fiber at the curb, fiber into the house, and I have 5 Google mesh network things for a 2,000 or 2,100 square foot. Well, the whole house is probably 2,800 square feet. It's over coverage. There's no issue here. Yeah, there's no issue here. And you just don't always see it. To your point, when we're in that RV, and I'm just talking out loud here as you're saying this and reflecting on it, I always was thinking, like, what the hell? Why is this piece of crap? And it's not a piece of crap, but it's not a high-end $5,000, $4,000, $3,000 TV. Why is this little RV TV so clear? And I guess it's because it's coming over the signal.
Yep. Over the air signal that's coming in. Exactly. Yep. And so, I mean, we're pretty excited. Obviously, we can get into where the signals came from and what's the whole history behind and where it was at 1.0 and what we're trying to do 3.0.
But, well, I actually want to know another question, which is, how do you know all this? So, I mean, you know a lot of stuff about spectrum, and I was excited to talk to you because I could ask all these questions that I don't know. I know enough to be dangerous. How do you, like, where does all this knowledge come from?
My history, I came to the United States when I was 16. Went studied physics at UC Santa Barbara.
Where'd you come from?
Half Turkish, half Swiss. I was born in Switzerland. My mom is Swiss from the French side. To be clear, for people who know in Switzerland, there's 3 languages, technically 4, but there's Swiss, German, Swiss, French, Italian. I'm the French side. So I do speak French with an accent, but I grew up in Turkey in Istanbul. My dad is Turkish, but I do have an accent in Turkish too, believe it or not. So when I came to US after high school at 16, go to Santa Barbara. I'm a gaucho. Studied physics there. And then went to San Diego State grad school. I continued for physics as well. And I love science. I love the business and technology side as well. Did 3 startups, worked in many different companies between my 30-year career. I won't get into them, but it's the 3 startups kind of defined in different areas what I did. I did a lot of hardware, a lot of software. I did on system level solutions as well. The first startup was in the early 1990s, we did one of the earliest Windows NT-based voice RIP solution for Nokia. I was Alcatel for the Bahamas, but it was semi-successful. We did a little bit of money when I was at the age of 27. I wasn't smart enough to keep that money and invest, but that was my first forte that made me realize that, you know, from science to looking at technology and doing solutions and creating money and value, not only for myself, but for the ecosystem of what can bring to. The second part was the later 90s was to create a web hosting solution. This is the days when we got a Penguin-based solution, one of the Linux original bond to tier ones, and we were the hosting website for businesses. We were actually literally had salespeople call, and their job was to convince businesses to who are in the yellow pages, you should have a website. They're going, why? That was the early days. But the last startup that I worked at, we did a software-defined radio solution at 220 megahertz for the railroad industry. So it was, there's a federal mandate that came along because of the tragic accident happened in LA, a freight train that collided. There were some fatalities, but more importantly, the freight train was carrying hazardous material. When it flipped, it cracked but didn't leak. But had it leaked, it was very downtown, highly populated area. The damage could have been catastrophic. So because of that federal mandate, they created that. They wanted to know where the trains are, when there's a mistake, how do you do? So we spent in that startup a lot of time doing a software-defined radio. At 220 megahertz, we went through all the transmission because this was very latency dependent. If there is no response from the trains within 10 seconds, it will stop all trains within 20 miles. Obviously, you don't want to do that too often. So there's a whole technology to go behind. We spend a lot of time. And so that is the physics behind. I was always interested, but the application side of it, that's really that last startup. I got really into it.
So you did three startups. Sounds like you started in your early 20s. You made some money, lost that money, or probably didn't lose it. You probably had a good time with it.
Probably through that.
Yes. Maybe too much. If you were to think back to those three startups, Al, what are the lessons, like the top three lessons you learned from doing those startups? This episode is sponsored by the Halle Financial Team at Expert Lending. Buying a house in today's market is competitive, and you need a lender that can close fast and get you the very best rate. The team is licensed in 48 states and has over 20 years experience in the real estate and lending space and access to lending rates that most mortgage brokers can't get. I know because I'm an investor in the team. If you need a mortgage or know someone that does, call or text Kara at 571-271-9086 and talk to a real human who will give you the customer service you deserve. Again, call or text Kara at 571-271-9086. 9086. Now back to the show.
So I will say let me go back to the web hosting. I think we had a great opportunity there. And then I'll tell you on that one, the failure. That one is a fail. The first one was a success just because we made some money there. Not like it blew up, but it made some money. But the second one was a good learning because looking back, we were not exactly too far ahead, you know, our time and what we were trying to do, because a company after us started a year and a half later, they were basically copied exactly what we were doing from the hosting model and everything that we have. Fast forward 10 years later, they sold the company for $200 million. So if we had, what we did, our mistake was we did not do our ROI budget analysis well enough, the cost, because doing a bond of two tier one line at that time, we were paying close to $10,000 a month. So when you just go through the numbers and you're charging $100 a year for email and the web hosting, et cetera, the numbers didn't make sense to be able to, you wouldn't be able to afford those two tier ones if you looked at it. So I will say this is a simple, it was not complicated. It was not technology. I believe the business model was right. But what we did not model correctly was we did the belief that we could get 100,000, 10,000 customers to break even and then start making money was not realistic. The timing was not right at that time. We should have scaled slower, not go far ahead as much as we did. And then nobody wants to invest in any company when they're losing money. Right. You will want to get the money always in the beginning when you have a great idea, but not that we have been into it for about a year and your original ROA was failing. So I always say plan ahead, look at it, scale accordingly, and keep your promises. Right. Nobody wants to invest in anybody who couldn't do what they said they were going to do. Right. Or you have to give up. So in the end, the last piece was we did find an investor, but they wanted 60% of the company. We're going a little better. It's better shutting it off. Then work, because the whole point of starting a startup, working for ourselves, right? With my partner, I'm not going to, it's better to shut it down.
So if I summarize what I heard there, it's that you didn't run your numbers in a simple Excel spreadsheet to truly model. So here's the thing that blows my mind. How does that happen?
Isn't that amazing? It's sometime you have when you have a great idea and you believe it, and it might be true. In this case, it was a great idea. It proved it. The company a year and a half later started that, sold over $200 million. So the idea was correct. But our assumptions were tied too much emotions, not logic. I was in my late 20s. This is after the first startup that we did immediately. And thinking that we could get, I can't remember the exact number, which I should, we needed about 10 to 12,000 businesses to sign up. Realistic, if you look at that time when some people didn't even know what internet is, let alone hosting a website. If we got 1,000, would have been successful, which we did. We should have done the business model to be more realistic, to think that everybody, so in that sense, we had unrealistic expectation what the market will do right away. You know, we should have seen that we may feel 10,000 is achievable, but then we should start with the 1,000 and then scale accordingly, because that's the mistake that I would say in the majority that happened.
Did you have an outbound call center?
Yeah, we had a very small team, 4 people, because we were focused on Southern California originally. The whole business plan was that, which is that time, if you remember, when you old, these are old dial-up 3-com modems that you
what
had.
What year was that?
This is 1998.
Yeah, 1998. I started my first company in 1996, and I did it, I think it was 28 baht. I was borrowing, I'm using that in air quotes for those listening, bandwidth from, I was working on my master's in psychology and borrowing it from the school, basically. But yeah, it was all dial up. And people didn't know what the internet, they thought the internet back then was AOL. But I mean, for the most part. And the truth is, I worked there in the early years and AOL controlled 30% of the backbone of the entire internet at one time, was coming through Ashburn, Virginia. But so it was, I still find it crazy that you can, and I have another question for you on this before we get off of it, is you're not you, but people, this is not an uncommon thing that you're saying.
No, here. I've seen many. That's why I've learned, because I do a lot of advising roles throughout my last 10 years career, especially more and more. Some of them has to do with due diligence, looking at startups when companies want to invest. I look at their technology, their positioning in the market. I also advise on their go-to-market, how they position, and also their business model, whether it makes sense. Because trust me, after that mistake, I'm like, okay, and you will think, to your point, this will be less, but it's actually very common. And what's more common, I would say mostly, is you should always look at, it's good to look at the highest expectation, in this case, 10,000, but that's really the high side. The low side should have been probably more like 100 and then expected 1,000. You can't use your business model as your 10,000 as your high and run all your numbers accordingly. That's insanity. And then I've seen that many times. They look at the best case scenario and build a business model accordingly. And you may succeed, but the chances of you succeeding is very low when you do that.
Yeah, there's some irony to that, which I'm going to bring up, but I'm still not. I think it's so important, and I'm harping on this, and if you're listening and you're thinking to yourself, Brandon, just let Alp continue. Yeah. I'm not doing it on purpose because smart people still don't run the Excel spreadsheet. And I had an example the other day. I was doing, a friend asked if I would look at a startup that he was considering being a part of and supporting and investing in. And I went through the idea, which took me like 5 minutes, literally. I got it. Seems to solve a problem. Show me your Excel spreadsheet. And they wouldn't send it to me beforehand. So they wanted to walk me through it.
Walk you through.
Walk me through it. Well, that's like a red flag. All right, walk me through it. And they're raising $750,000. And they know that they have to build a piece of technology. They have some of it, but they got to get into the market. And it's a $10,000 plus a year software product.
Okay.
Not huge. This is not like we're talking about TV and Spectrum, right, and broadcasting, like 10,000 bucks or in bandwidth, would we just burn that in a second ago, putting this, like, you know, the AT&T on the fiber network? But it still puts you at a larger SMB business who's going to buy a $10,000.
Not everybody will do that.
Right. Yeah. So that's one thing. They have no customers. They did have some customers in another country, but not in the US. So the US is basically going to be like, yeah, that's interesting, but do you have one here? So I'm just saying it's going to take a minute to get to market.
Yeah.
And they had planned for it, I would say, through a medium. That's your water, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Through a medium. And if you need more, we have it. Through a medium, I guess, a medium aggressive plan. Great. So I said, hey, can you do me a favor and take your cursor and drag it across the bottom of your first 12 months? Because, you know, they had pay, quote unquote, payroll and expenses and all this stuff. You know, equaled, I think it was, and I could be off here, so don't quote me, but it was like $1.3 million. And I said, but you're raising $750,000. And this is an example that I'm putting out there on purpose that they actually did do their numbers, but somebody forgot to drag the cursor on the bottom to see what happened. And I said, so you're raising 750, you're burning like 1.3 or whatever it was, 1.4 at 12 months, which means that you have half a year's worth of money. If you even hit the two customers that you had at 20 grand, which is just not even worth talking about
exactly.
At 750.
Yep.
And that means you're going to have to raise money at month three to get the money at month six of when you run out. How would someone invest in that? And my point is that these are super smart people. They still don't do it. So if there's a lesson in here, you got to run the spreadsheet, man. Like, it's painful. Yeah. But here's my question to you on the other side. So if you don't do the 10,000 customer in that projection, do the investors give you money?
True. So I'll give you the personal experience and the one that I was advising that's invested. You have to always show, because some investors, they always look at, you know, I've seen some VC firms I've advised and they go, we won't invest in anything less than 50x return potential, right? You have to show those pie in the sky numbers. But you have to tie into a projection. You always put the star next to it. And then you always have to, depending on what you're doing, this is just generality from 12 months or 36 months. If you're doing a grounds up design R&D work and IP development, it's not going to be 12, it's probably more like 36 months. But let's just assume things that you have to base, to your point, your money needs to be tied to a phase 1, 2, 3, or stages 1, 2, 3, 4, depending on what the terminology people use. And each stage needs to be tied to either deliverables of an IP that you're working on, let's say on what you have, or deliverables of a first use case on the customer. It's not about making money, but more proving it out. And there's somebody, so you have this tied to something that they have. And to your point, what you're talking about earlier, your money, what you're asking, and I'll say at least 18 to 24 months has to match to what you're asking for, period. If whatever reason it is, you can come up with those 10,000 down the road, and that's a question to have if you came at 1,000, but so long as you're not losing money and you are generating revenue and you can market conditions change, but you still are within your development stage and you meet all those, there is still recovery for you from the money. It's not an easy one, but recovery. But if your projections were off and you're losing money. When I say lose money, you ask for 750 and you're actually spending 1.3. That means you have no control. You have no idea what you're doing. It's a trust issue. At that point, even the best ideas, no money. They will not get any money.
I basically told them that. And you and I just met today and we had lunch, but I think you know enough right now that I just tell it how it is. I think we were talking about, and you're like, did that guy actually say that to you? And I said, yeah, because the atmosphere in the startups startups, whatever the right word is, early stage companies, is that I found that if you do not have brutal honesty, then what happens is what happens in your first company, which is everybody's riding on this feeling.
Exactly.
And you can't argue with feelings.
No.
And then people get offended, whatever that means, which actually I'm saying that loosely, because what it means is being offended is the other person doesn't do that to you. You're offended yourself. So I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but the bottom line is that people aren't honest with one another. And I would rather be honest and stay in business than not. And I told them what you just said. I said, all your credibility is now lost with me.
Yeah, exactly.
You were probably smart not to send me your spreadsheet, because I would have read it, not even taken this meeting. I would have said, go back to the numbers and rework them.
Yeah.
Or I might have taken the meeting because I was doing a favor for a friend. However, it just, you look dumb. I mean, I don't know how else to say it, but I do want to say that I think there's a double-edged sword. And I have sat on both sides of the table as a venture capitalist, as an angel investor, which I still do, and as an entrepreneur, which I like that side of the table better for me. I'm not saying just for me, I like it better. I don't know, it's probably suicidal, but I like to create things from nothing and then build them. But I think that there is this balance to your point. And there's pressure, because as soon as you raise the money, I bet you those people wanted you to spend it, because they don't want you sitting on the money.
Correct. Exactly.
And I fought that fight before myself. And at some point, you know, it gets to a point, they want their capital to be at work. But I think what you said is there's another valuable lesson, which is you can't outrace the market. The market doesn't care that you raised money.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Yep. Yeah,
exactly. So in your case, you know, and then another thing that you said that I want to talk about is the cap table. That there's so many dimensions that you have to think about this, because you could have raised money. They would have diluted you.
Yep.
And you would basically just go work for a big company at that point.
You got it. Yep. And that's a choice you make. And we could have stayed and maybe we made some money at the end, but that's not what you don't want to do. Everybody has different goals, but at that point, I might as well work for another company, right? You have some ownership in stake, but that's not what we wanted to do, right? So
any other things that come to mind? I mean, there's a lot of important lessons that I just think is worth pointing out since we're talking about it, but that come to mind from the mistakes you made?
I'll say actually the other one would be careful. This is just talking about startups, right? Be careful the markets you go into. Not sharing too much. It's like when you go into the certain businesses, if you look at it from the technical acumen only, you have to look at the elements of where is the existing market? Where did they come from? And there are some markets has been in the business for 100, 200 years. And to break into it as a newcomer, doesn't matter how good it is, the best price, best technology, best everything, the logical things, like when you look at things non-emotionally, but logically, if I do all these things, I should be the winner. It's very naive. That's another learning from the last startup I had. That's not the case in some places. Some places that's not true, but for certain markets, it's the, what I call good old way network, the connections, where it came from is more important than the solutions and the products and the technology it brings. Eventually it does change, but you may not be around to see that, because that could take 10, 20 years to get to that point. So you got to be careful on areas on not only the Excel sheets, the numbers, and your differentiation, but is the market ready to accept a newcomer in? Is it a brand new market or is it an established market? And if they are, can they accept you? And if they're not, you better have a good friend in the inside to promote you.
I think that's I won't go deep into it, but there are markets that I played in where that's actually true. And I got to be honest with you, it wore me out, because it's all about the connections and not the solution. And as a person who tends to be logical, it really will wear you out.
Yes,
because makes no sense.
Yes, exactly. It wore me off. That was my last one. That they are still doing business, not to where it should be. But for me, it wore me out, because it was not logical. It was about connections, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's very hard to compete on connections and social goodwill. It's just not going to do well. Well, if you heard that listeners, my wife can't keep the dog under control today. I mean, we have the door open because it's hot here in Half Moon Bay. Hot for us is like 65. But yeah, I think that that's a, I think it's true. I think it's hard to figure that out, but I do think you can do your diligence beforehand. I don't know. What do you think?
Like, oh, you have to do it beforehand. I mean, look, to me, if I'd done my job and looked at it differently, because I looked at it logically and looked at the differences and looked at what was out there, it was a no-brainer. And I should have looked deeper into the market to understand who are the old players. That would have been very apparent, because a year later, it was clear as day. I knew that it was a mistake. From day one, I should have seen that, never gone that path. But you learn through your success, but as much as your failures, right? So that one, I should have done a little bit more due diligence. It's not numbers, not technology. It was about who will buy this. Are they ready to buy you and why? And do you really understand it, right? It's not about timing. Timing was right. Everything was right. Money was there, but not the buyers. So,
what do you think about this that I'm going to point the finger at myself too, but over these companies that you've done and seen, most people don't call. So when people say, do your diligence, right? Or talk to the customer, they actually don't talk to the customer. I think it's super hard because we get into this echo chamber of ourself and this self-licking ice cream cone that we're convincing ourselves that this is like the best idea in the world. And I've seen, and this has happened to me, and I it's terrible. I hate it, but there's Steve Blank teaches Lean Startup. And one of the things, and I agree with most of his stuff, he's super smart, super successful. I think lean startups are, I think that I tend to believe a little bit more of the spreadsheet and the business plan, not taking 8 weeks to do it, but at least come up. And he does do that, but it's a little faster. But one thing that I love about his program is that he says you got to call 100 customers in 1 week, potential customers.
Okay.
Yeah. And most people have that for those who aren't watching, Alp sort of raised his eyebrows to the top of the ceiling here and is like, what? But let's talk about that. I don't know. Why couldn't you call? Like, what more important thing could there be? What more important thing could a business owner do in the early stages than spend 1 week every day calling potential customers?
So fair enough. So to me, yeah, part of it with PXA, what we're doing with ATSC 3.0, the first issue was when my partner, Chris, close friend of mine, when he came to me and said, hey, you know, there's an opportunity. Some of the broadcasters are looking at ATSC 3.0. I'm like, I'm in the RF business in IoT Edge. I'm like, what is that? Never heard of it. I'm like, well, me neither. Can you look into it? Because they're trying to monetize this business, right? I'm like, all right, let me look into it. A week later, I came back. Look, there's some, we're not going into detail, we can maybe talk later on, but I said, there's some options here. I think there's tremendous value, but let's think through. The answer is yes, but I need to put a business plan together. Let's think it through and then see what goes on. So we kind of went through the business plan and broadcaster liked the idea. Hey, let's talk further. By the way, negotiation did take 9 months, but one of the first thing I did was, first of all, from my past mistakes.
I'm interrupting you on purpose. So why didn't you call 50 customers before you locked in the deal? And did you do that?
Yes, I did. That's okay. What I was going to get
okay.
to.
Okay. Yeah.
So what I did, not 100, because, and the reason I was going to explain to you is that my goal was not 100, it was 20. 20 trusted, and I use on purpose 20 different people that I know in the industry, their potential customers with different industry background, from industrial automation, digital signage. They're in the cellular IoT, what I'm going to call IoT cellular integration solutions, things like that, where I knew them, they would listen to me. Except one, 19 of them had never heard of ATSC 3.0. So that took almost, I would say, 1 to 2 hours just to explain what it is, because they're going, what is it? Why? Right. So we have to go through this television broadcast. We have to explain. And then once they go through, I'm like, okay, let me think through them. Well, it took me literally, generally speaking, two calls. One was, let me send you the information. I'll go through. Here's some ideas. They have a follow-up call after you've digested, thought through. Right. So that was my strategy. That's what I did with 20. But that took a good 2.5 months. to go through the whole cycle to get that done, to get the feedback.
But you weren't doing that full time, were you?
No, no.
Right.
So, yeah, you could do more. That's true. If you are now, once the business has started, you should be able to do that and get as many. But my thought was, I want that information before I sign up on this deal. Because if you do it, you sign it and then you get the feedback from a customer, not that it's late, you should still do it, but it's after the fact.
Yeah, that's what I was. I figured you had talked to them because you don't.
Well, 100 would have been a lot. Sorry.
Well, you know what? If you don't, I mean, I think the point is,
yeah,
if you shoot for 10 and you're probably going to get 5.
True.
You shoot for 100 and you get 30 or 40 or 50, then, and if we're, you're doing here at Peak an enterprise product, but if you're doing a consumer product,
Yeah,
there's no reason.
Absolutely,
you can't,
no
you
reason.
Could call every single person you know and post it on Facebook.
Yep, absolutely.
So I think that number, but he doesn't, from my studying that method, he doesn't distinguish. And I'm pretty sure it's 100. If it's not 100, it's close to it. And I think the idea is to call. And that always sticks in my mind. I have a question for you, because the other thing that mistake that I've done in the past is that I will talk to the people. They will say, yes, they will say, yeah, I want that. Oh, I have that problem. Yeah. Makes sense. And then when I come back and I'm like, okay, it's $39.95 or $109 or whatever it is based on the markets I've been in. It's like, oh. So how do you think about that in the sense that they say they want it, they say it's important, you go through with something, and then you go back to them to get the money to do the deal, and they're like, oh, well. So what does that affect? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, so from the stuff that I've done, a lot of time they may say yes to you because they're a friend. You have to be careful to interpret what they're saying. They may even say it's a good idea, but that doesn't mean they're going to implement it ever. I 100% agree with you. So it's more of a numbers game. At the end of the day, if you're relying on one partner that you have and truly qualify, I mean, to me, the part of it has to do with when they say yes, what do they mean? Can you qualify it further? Does it, yes, a good idea, or yes, is it beneficial to their business that we'll do today, not tomorrow? Because if it's tomorrow or next year, doesn't mean they're going to get it today, right? So I don't know. It comes down to not knowing. That was my thing, because I've seen it. There are different explanations and what we have, but it's all about what you promote and who they are to you, and how do you go around their objections that they have. And a lot of time, things that I've done is, I would say, 50%, I've not done enough qualification to understand. I'm making that number up, but it was high, right? It was more, I didn't truly understand if their needs were for then, right? They still like the idea. It's just more not ready for it. Things like that.
Right? Well, I appreciate you sharing that, because I just think it's worth talking about it. Even experienced people like us, having done a lot of these, still make the mistakes. And I just think that you've really got to be diligent and do those things, and it just saves you so much time.
Yep, correct.
In the end. So let's switch in gears here. What is going on with Peak? What is your goals? From a technology standpoint, business standpoint, I do feel like using that spectrum, going back to your Super Bowl or football, was it Super Bowl?
Super Bowl, yep.
Super Bowl example. Is that you really can have a better experience in broadcast by using this spectrum to do it. So what is your goal with that? Because I could easily see this. The only thing that keeps me hesitating is that you, in some of the devices, you would have to get the chip or hardware installed to be able to receive it. But this isn't magic. This is a TV receiver. Like, is it a chip?
It's a chip, basically. It's small. So Sony, very small, said less than 2 watts, right? It's a
I mean, it's how small? Part.
It's a dollar part. So we're talking about maybe quarter size of a stamp, one quarter.
A quarter of the size of a stamp, and it's a dollar.
It's a dollar-ish. So you can get a US, basically fit into a USB stick, right? So if you look
It can fit into a phone.
Technically, yes, it can. So that's one of the things being done right now. Obviously, Peak3's focus is not consumer side. So broadcaster themselves, Samsung, others, because this is being utilized. So ATSC 3.0 is in US. It's not a global standards, right? So there are nations out there. So from South Korea, India, United States. So there are others where like so Europe is a different standard. But they are looking at to be able to, Samsung is looking in South Korea as an example. India has a lot of standards being deployed right now. I don't think it's been ratified yet, but they're close to being get done so that your tablets, your cell phones will have an ATSC chip. It can be done easily. It's been proposed. Because now can you imagine this is not Peak3's focus, but imagine if your cell phone can receive a video, any content data directly over the air.
Well, actually, my question is, it sort of is Peak3's business. That's not your end customer, but it's the ultimate customer.
Ultimate customer, correct. We're not going to be going after Samsung phone, trying to convince them to put the chip in there. Even though Samsung makes an ATSC 3.0 chip, that's a different division, right? So, and then you have Sony making a chip as well. So if you look at a lot of big ATSC 3.0, sponsors are TV manufacturers, which is not a surprise because, you know, that's their bread and butter, and that's what they want to be able to continue selling it. And you see the broadcasters, which also makes sense, right? You have the LG, Samsung, the Sony's, and then the broadcasters own there. But for us, while having the chip in the phone is important from the consumer perspective, but we are looking at more from the industrial applications on usage. Very similar to what we did 20 plus years ago when cellular industry was up and coming, the early 2000s, and originally it was for consumers only, generally speaking. And then you saw the utilization of cellular IoT solution. At that time, they didn't call it IoT. It was called machine-to-machine, M2M, before that something else. But reality, it's all the same. It's all edge computing, edge devices. And it was to do with sensors, data acquisition, and doing something with that data at the edge, whether that's a factory floor or for digital signage, or it could be in a wind turbine. It really doesn't matter at the end of the day. They're all the same. They sit on the edge. They have a purpose. They're doing something. They're either collecting data or they're doing actionable things with the data they're receiving either from the edge or from the cloud. So it's all about network traffic, north and southbound. What do you do with it? How do you do it? How quickly can you do with it? Can you guarantee the data? And can you manage all that data? It was simpler in the back days. Today, what we have is we believe the ATSC 3.0 becomes another venue, another way to provide solutions that enhances all the current providers that's already out there. Not replacing, but enhancing them.
And what's the max bandwidth that you can get over that?
So we have available channels. So Peak3 currently, we have signed 8+8, 16-year sub-licensing agreement. So we are not a license holder. Obviously, these are federally licensed solution to broadcasters. But we have gotten 8+8, 5 megabit channel to be able to deliver data over with the ability to get more if we need to. Right. So, and we have the coverage wise, the 3.0 should be able to, there's a differing opinions how quickly it will become because of it's all about CapEx investment and what, but my belief, we're at already about 65%. If you look at all the broadcasters where they are, there are different numbers out there, but I firmly believe that in the next 18 months, we should get into 85 to 95% range. And after that should be covered and 1.0 will be phased out at that point. But so it's not an if, it's just a matter of timing. Some believe will be sooner, some believe will be a little bit later, but regardless, that's the coverage.
But how does that affect your business that you need that 3.0 receiver hardware in it to make sure that it can receive it? Is that the...
100% correct. So today, there's a lot of consumer solutions. You will see them out there on Amazon. Whether those are even Raspberry Pi solutions that you could see developer kits for people to do their own set-top box with a little hard drive. So you could actually turn into a beautiful DVR, 4-channel receiver. So that means you can actually receive 4 simultaneous channels and record them if you wanted to. those are really good for the consumer market, but our focus is more if you look at the vertical markets from digital signage, automotive, fleet management. If you look at factory floor, factory automation, building automation, if you look at the energy electric utility, imagine having the ability to send a data for the appliances inside of a house or the electric meter. When maybe there's an emergency and you want to shut down your AC system, you can send the commands without relying on the Wi-Fi system, gas systems, things like that, which you have. So these are all the areas we're focusing on. And all those vertical markets, in short, needs a more hardened receiver, smaller receiver. With receiver have different specs. So we're working on the hardware side. We're not don't want to be in the hardware business. We are working on an ecosystem of partners to convince them this is a market for them to build. There are a lot of companies out there in the comm business so that they can be the provider and we can provide the bandwidth.
And you can you encrypt over that?
Absolutely. So one of the biggest interesting part that we can, while there's a standard security, all the things that's available, and not want to get in detail, very similar. So this, by the way, this is ORAN compliant, meaning it's the IP backbone so that it is compatible. So any data that you deliver over an ATSC signal acts like an IP connectivity, right? So the blocks that comes in and resides, you can store the file or you can stream the video real time, play it, but it's based on the IP network. So there's a much easier for end users to create application, utilize on what they want to do with the data that's coming in. So because of that, now customers of ours have the ability to create their own encryption models to be able to transmit for their signal. Because obviously, one of the first questions I got was, well, this is broadcast. Everybody in the world can listen. So if you have a tuner, you have a receiver, I can get the data. And if you are, say, doing a firmware update for these devices all across the United States, you want to make sure security is hardened in ways that you feel comfortable being able to deliver that data over the air. My reality is I'm not as concerned from security because I think your security is compromised just as much on an IP network that's not over the air. But nonetheless, it is over the air, so they can actually modulate, they can do encryption on the air signal itself, but they can also create their own proprietary encryption modules that can be uploaded and transmitted through the air so that only their receivers can receive and be able to decode it.
So they can create basically a VPN over the wavelength.
In essence, basically, you could do that, absolutely.
I mean, that's what they're creating, a pipe, or they're encrypting the data. And their two keys on either end are authenticating. So somebody might know that if they were trying to listen, I guess, to that spectrum, that something was going over, but they couldn't find out what it was.
Exactly. I mean, no different than if you're spoofing on a network, listening on the network, someone's on IP traffic on a LAN or Wi-Fi. By the way, I can go to public and do the same thing on Wi-Fi. No different than that. It's encrypted. I can see a signal between A and B, but unless you have the encryption key or ways to decrypt it, it's going to be garbage.
It would also look like possibly TV signal.
Absolutely.
The, what was I going to say? When you said that you didn't want to go into the consumer, is that because consumer market is that because you think that's too big and too hard to get to and you would rather move into some niches where you don't have to put the, what happens if everybody puts that chip in the phone at that point? Would that change your mind?
No, because they have an auxiliary offering. So the broadcasters own the video content and the delivery. So from the bit, it's not that I don't believe in it. I absolutely 100% believe, but our charter or what we want to do is something what the broadcaster are not doing, because their goal is to put it in. They benefit because now instead of having TV, now you have more TVs, if you want to call it that way. So this, we're not in the TV business for the same reason, because that's what broadcast has been doing it for decades. So that is the investment that's been done from the broadcaster perspective for Peak 3 is to find new utilization of places that they're not originally playing in. So today, the phone, the medium of the phone or a tablet is really an extension of a TV.
Got it.
That's why. That's that.
Yeah, it's just another screen.
Yep.
They just enabled another screen. And is it true that, let's use this example, there's a tower that broadcasts this spectrum, which is already being done. We are here at this recording studio. That tower has a given power output. Given that all those things stay static, including our distance from that tower, and let's say we receive 5 megs here. Let's just say it's a 5 meg connection. And everybody on my street tries to get that. There's no degradation of that signal. It's one to many.
That's
so
correct.
We all get it regardless of how many people are pulling it at that strength.
Exactly. And we were talking about this earlier. So not only that example of you and your neighbors, but imagine you went to the 49ers game and you were on your cell phone or whatnot, and you were all doing the same thing, all 60,000 fans, all the signal will be exactly the same quality, right? Because there's no difference between one fan or versus 60,000 fans.
I think that's very powerful. I got to let you know that you actually have a customer call in 10 minutes.
That's correct. I just realized when I just said that.
It's like time flying through here, hasn't it? But this has been a fascinating conversation. I'm excited for it. I could geek out and talk about this forever. My rule is always, I don't care what we're doing, customers always come first. Like, you should drop investor meetings. You shouldn't drop everything for sales calls. So with that, we're going to wrap up here. Where can listeners best find out about Peak 3?
So if you go to peak3spectrum.com, you can find information on there. And please also watch out. You will see on my LinkedIn, I will make sure on this podcast, I'll add, we will have a press release coming out about our company and what we are doing, our charter, in the next 2 weeks or ish, something like that. And then following about a week to 2 weeks after that, you will see a white paper coming around with two other partners. Both on the edge distributed architecture, and the other one is a private LTE partner of ours. So you will see edge caching as a service, what it would look like technical from the business aspect. Please look at those. And any questions, I would love to be able to get in feedback and thought process. You know, our host here was nice enough to challenge a lot of the things I had. I'd rather people challenge me and say that's not a great idea to know now than instead of a year later.
Well, yeah, I'm not scared to challenge Alps. I don't know if I'm right. I just ask a lot of questions. So if I was, don't take that as anything. I just am always super interested in this stuff and like to get to the bottom of it. And you've been great. It's been fun. For those listening, we actually had lunch before this and we've been talking about this for 3 hours. So super fun. Thanks for coming on. I'll put everything in the show notes and really appreciate you coming out and best of luck with everything. We'll have to have you back on when you're out here again in a few months and get an update.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah. Thanks, Al. Bye, everyone.